Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Drower, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We're here today to discuss the decision handed down on May 11th in Prococo v. United States. It's my honor to introduce our guest today, Gary Lukowski. He's currently counsel at the Dillon Law Group, where he works on political law, election law, administrative law, appellate issues, and nonprofit issues. Prior to joining the Dillon Law Group, he served at the Department of the Interior, directly advising the secretary and other senior department leaders, and as a senior policy advisor at the White House Domestic Policy Council, and we're very happy to have him on SCOTUScast to talk about Prococo. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here this morning.
So I guess to start us off, can we talk a little bit about the background of the case as kind of a quick summary and refresher before we get into the decision itself?
Absolutely. So I always describe it as it's the axiom, bad facts make bad law. So the petitioner here is hardly what anyone would describe as the platonic ideal of good government, good kind of conduct here. He has been described as a close friend of Governor Andrew Cuomo. He served as his executive deputy secretary when he was governor. In 2014, Governor Cuomo is running for re-election. Mr. Prococo leaves the governor's office to go help run his campaign, basically. While he's managing the campaign, he also has a desk at the executive mansion. He's kind of coming and going. There's the perception he has a foot kind of in both worlds. So while he's managing the campaign, he's off the government payroll. He's approached by this New York businessman through an intermediary who tells him, hey, I've got this problem. The government's requiring me to enter into what's called a labor peace agreement with this union to receive state funding for a project I want to work on. I think that's going to be really expensive. I don't think it's necessary. You know, while you're, quote, off the second floor, you're not on the payroll, can you help me sort of sort this out? And in order to do that, I'm going to pay you. I'm going to structure this through a $35,000 payment through your wife, through a couple of transactions, through an intermediary, which, if you're, as a pro tip, if you're structuring your payments through intermediaries and other people, that's a good way to get kind of negative attention from regulatory authorities. Now, so after receiving this payment, Mr. Prococo contacts officials in the state agency that was at issue, urge them to move forward with this agreement, says, hey, do we really need this labor peace agreement? Do you need that? I don't think so. So then the agency reverses its position. A few days later, Prococo goes back into government, goes back to work for Governor Cuomo. And so in looking at those facts, you can see where, DOJ is looking at that and where others might be looking at that and saying, there's something kind of sketchy going on here. Wait a minute, this guy's got a foot in both worlds. He seems to be influencing these things. What's kind of going on? There's other sort of sordid details that came out of the trial level that kind of were not positive for him, such as referring to money as ZD and making other Sopranos references, which again, as a pro tip, if you're going to engage something kind of on the ethical line, maybe don't make mob references while you're doing it. But, as Justice Kagan and others have noted, not every corrupt act by a state or local official is a federal crime. And as Justice Scalia has put it, bad men like good men are entitled to be tried and sentenced in accordance with the law. So then we get to the legal history. So DOJ looks at these facts, they bring charges and connect him with this scheme and some other activities he had. The main ones for this, though, were honest services, wire fraud, and Hobbs Act extortion, basically soliciting of bribes and gratuities. Now at trial, Prococo argues, hey, I can't commit these crimes. I'm not a public official at the time. I didn't owe anyone this duty of honest services. I'm just basically a lobbyist. I'm a private citizen lobbying government to kind of get what we want out of this. Now, the trial court interestingly agreed with respect to Hobbs Act, which requires a person to commit extortion under sort of color of official right. And kind of concluded, well, you didn't have an official right. You couldn't do that. It disagreed with respect to honest services and bribery. And on those counts, the jury returned sort of a split decision. They convicted him on honest services, acquitted him on solicitation of bribes. So, and he was also convicted on another charge sort of unrelated to that. that sort of builds into this idea of you can see why DOJ is looking at this dude. Now, he appeals his conviction to the Second Circuit, arguing in part, again, hey, I can't commit honest services fraud. I don't owe any duty. I'm not a public official. As a private citizen, I'm just a normal lobbyist, basically. The Second Circuit looked at that and disagreed. It held that any private citizen who is relied on by the government and who in fact controls some aspect of government business owe the same fiduciary duty to the public as a government official. Elsewhere, the court described it as owing a duty when, you know, a person's dominated and controlled any government business and people working for government actually relied on them due to some sort of special relationship, whatever happens to be. There's some question about, you know, how crucial special relationship was in there versus just the dominated and controlled and actual reliance. And so that kind of sets the stage for this case. It came up to the Supreme Court with the petitioner saying, wait a minute, I can't be convicted of honest services because one, I'm not a government employee. And two, this test the Second Circuit has set up is way too vague, way too overbroad. That could be anyone who exercises control over government business. That could be every lobbyist basically is in trouble if this is the standard. Where do we draw this line? And that kind of sets the stage for this case.
All right, thank you for that. So I guess transitioning now to the decision, can we talk about what it says and kind of the breakdown of the reasoning?
So it's a 9-0 decision on the judgment, at least. There are two separate opinions that kind of break down three different ways. And this continues a broader trend with this court of relatively narrow sort of unanimous opinions rejecting these broad creative theories of corruption. We saw that in McDonnell a few years ago, which was the case out of Virginia where the governor was accused of accepting these things to basically take meetings. And the court said, wait, you need to do more than that. We saw it also in a case called Kelly v. United States, which was a Bridgegate decision stemming from the closure of certain bridges in New Jersey. And we also saw it on the same day this case came down in another case called Criminelli v. United States, also out of the Second Circuit. Basically, these are all sort of unanimous decisions saying, let's be real careful expanding these theories of fraud and expanding these theories of corruption beyond kind of their core elements. And I mean, one could look at them as sort of a brushback on these broader theories. And that sort of falls in line with a long tradition in the court of doing that. It goes back at least 30, 40 years at this point. Traditionally, under wire fraud and under theories of fraud, there had to be some connection to a tangible deprivation of property. And this was also the issue in Criminelli, ironically. Now, over time, this theory developed that if a person accepted that you could commit fraud, even if they weren't deprived of property, you were depriving them of honest services. So kind of an example of what this might entail is something like, let's say I'm a contracting officer with, you know, some sort of federal agency or state agency. You offer me $15,000 to give you a contract. You also happen to submit the lowest bid. Now, under a theory of property fraud, that may not necessarily, under a very narrow theory of property fraud, that's not necessarily fraud. I haven't defrauded you as my employer because you're still getting the lowest bid. Under an honest services theory, though, I've deprived you of my honest judgment because I'm getting paid off to do this. So up through the 1980s, this theory kind of bubbles up through the court as part of wire fraud and part of the idea of, hey, we think honest services is part of fraud. Well, one of those cases was a Second Circuit decision called Maggiotti. It involved a county political party chairman accepting money from outside parties to influence government decisions. So the idea was sort of, here's this guy who the government thinks and the court thinks is kind of making these decisions on behalf of the government, even though he's not actually a government official. We're going to charge him with honest services fraud. He's kind of the real power behind the throne, so we're going to go after that. And that's where the theory that the Second Circuit applied in this case came from. That's where they kind of came up with this idea. But now there's an intervening event between kind of that decision in 1982 and today. And that's been kind of the court's consistent pushback on these broadening theories of honest services and broadening theories of wire fraud. So in 1987, you get another case, McNally v. United States, that says, hey, guys, cut it out with this stuff. Stop expanding fraud, at least in the courts, beyond the traditional sort of scope of fraud. If you want to do this, you got to actually go to Congress. You got to write a law about it. And in doing so, they relied on the idea that this is, you know, about property. So Congress comes back almost immediately and says, hey, well, we hear you. Here's an honest services statute. Go for it. That has also kind of been controversial in the court. And the court has again kind of tried to narrow that in. So in 2010, you get the Skilling case, which involved the former CEO of Enron. And basically, that was the first sort of hard look at honest services. And there you got a split decision where they basically said, we're going to uphold honest services, but only on the idea that it's very narrow. It basically only applies to bribery. And that's our saving construction to avoid vagueness concerns. Now, Justice Scalia disagreed with that opinion. In his view, honest services was irredeemably vague and presciently sort of warned that this limiting construction would not solve the most fundamental indeterminacy, the character of the fiduciary capacity to which the bribe and kickback restriction applies. In other words, exactly what we have here, he's warning about, well, 13 years ago of, well, wait a minute, that's great to say, but who does that apply to? So that brings us kind of to here, where you've had this line of cases that have sort of constrained honest services and constrained these broad theories of corruption. So we get two opinions in a 9-0 judgment. The first one's the majority opinion written by Justice Alito. He held that the jury instructions in this case were too vague. Specifically, the majority indicated that merely assigning a duty of honest services to a person who crosses some ill-defined threshold of influence is impermissibly vague. We don't know what that means. We don't know how to sort of assess that. You can't do that. You can't do this thing. Now, the majority also went on to have a couple other statements, a couple other things to say about this. So they also ruled, I would argue this is in dicta, but it's dicta that seems to be backed by 7 justices, so I would take it seriously if you're kind of looking at it. You know, that there's not a category rule that private citizens can't commit honest services fraud. So they're kind of rejecting this theory that Prococo had of, I'm not a government employee, I can't do this, and saying, well, there is some line you can cross where even if you're not formally on the payroll, you still owe this duty. They put it in terms of sort of traditional agency law, that if you're an agent of the government, we think you probably owe a duty of honest services. Again, I would argue that's in dicta, but it's dicta that's worth kind of taking seriously. Now, in a portion that of the opinion that Justice Jackson did not join, who was one of the 7 in that majority opinion, the court also analyzed 2 other arguments that were put forward by the government, sort of as they made their way through the courts. And they were first that honest services attaches when a person has been selected to work for the government in the future, and second that it attaches when a person exercises the authority of government with the acquiescence of relevant government personnel. The majority kind of rejected that second theory as, well, wait a minute, that's, you're just rephrasing the same thing we just said you can't do, so no. They neither confirmed nor rejected the first theory that's sort of basically saying, well, that was not what you asked for. You know, it's kind of one of those, as a lawyer, be careful what you ask for, you might get it. DOJ asked for broader jury instructions, they got them. He wasn't convicted on that, therefore, that's not before the court right now. Reading between the lines, though, if you're looking at that opinion, there seems to be a suggestion that at least 6 justices may think that's somewhere that could have been fine. That if you had drawn the line there, you might have been fine, but you didn't here, so too bad, basically. So that brings us to the concurrence. So there's a concurrence in the case from 2 justices, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas. This sort of builds on Justice Scalia's old opinion from Skilling, and it's the idea that this whole thing is basically an exercise in futility. The statute is too vague. They indicated the majority opinion doesn't really clarify for the public when honest services duties attach. The court is essentially acting as a legislature, rewriting the statute as they go for the people and for the Congress. And that honest service, the statute as written, is impermissibly vague and should really, this should go back to Congress. Again, that's sort of the same arguments Scalia raised. And something that sort of keeps coming up because these cases keep coming up.
So what would the implications of this kind of clarified definition be going forward? Or is this a little bit more of a, you know, case-specific decision?
So personally, I think there's a lot of merit to at least the overarching critique in Justice Gorsuch's concurrence that the majority doesn't really provide a lot of concrete guidance that I think is going to help people going forward. They provide some. So there is some guidance there. There is the idea that, all right, it's not a bright line, official, not official. It's something more than influence. It's something like agency. But your guess is as good as mine, kind of what that's going to end up meaning. And if I were kind of predicting, I would think that's somewhere I would watch. This is a theory that sort of keeps popping up every few years. DOJ keeps looking for other ways to kind of get at this idea of, this is really sketchy, unethical conduct. It must be illegal somehow. And they keep reaching for this statute as a way to kind of get at it. So I think one implication would be, if I were looking at that in the future, I would be watching out for broad interpretations of agency. So the court seems to be suggesting, we think if you're acting as an agent of government, you owe this duty of honest services. If I'm being cynical, I think you're going to see a lot of the same theories that you would have seen under this theory pop up, only now we're going to basically replace dominate and control with the word agent and see if that will fly. So I think the court thinks they're drawing on this broader kind of body of agency law. I think you're going to see an attempt to kind of stretch that whenever it's convenient, and we'll see how that goes. I hope I'm wrong, but I think that if I were watching out, I think that's one area to watch for is there room for mischief around the word agency? Now, I think the implication of this, and I think that if I were the one making the charging decisions, I think you can look at the history of the courts, at least over the last 5-6 years, and look at these sort of 9-0 opinions as a bit of a brushback and say, maybe I need to rethink if I want to keep doing that, and if I want to keep taking these broad positions at the trial level to then lead to these jury instructions that keep getting overturned by the court. So the optimistic view would be, look at it and say, it's another brushback, let's sort of limit this to the core sort of corrupt activity that's meant to get at, and stop kind of trying to expand the statute to be an all-purpose ethics regulation. The more sort of cynical take would be, watch the agency space and watch for attempts to kind of define agency much more broadly to get at sort of the same concepts that you have here. And to preview, I think that's going to cause some of the same problems you have here of, well, if you start expanding that, how do I know if I fall into that category or not? So, I mean, maybe I'm just a pessimist, but these cases seem to pop up every 3 or 4 years where you have this overreach and this attempt to expand the wire fraud statute into these new areas that they don't really fit. The court brushes it back, and then next 3 to 4 years, you have it again.
All right. So I guess kind of drawing us towards the end of our episode, are there any additional things that you'd like to touch on the case or mention about it? Or do you think we've unpacked it well?
We've unpacked it pretty well. I mean, I think a couple kind of lessons to take away from it are, one, bad facts make bad law. I mean, the facts here are not great for the petitioner, and I think that's part of what was animating what you saw happen here. I think another thing is, as a lawyer, you know, be careful what you wish for. You might get it, and it might not be what you want. DOJ wanted broad jury instructions. They got them. They probably would have won a narrower jury instructions. I mean, there are a lot of facts here you could have pulled from for a narrower target. That, at least reading between the lines, it seemed like there would have been some majority support on the court for, that they chose not to do. And that's kind of put them in this position of going through all this and losing a case like this. I think another kind of thing to watch out for is the further development of honest services. Obviously, I mean, you've had a 7-2 split here. It'll be interesting to see if this keeps happening, if there's any movement there, or if there's any kind of desire to either at the congressional level or at the court to kind of go back and look at honest services and say, is there a way to actually define what we're really getting at here? And in the broader sense, it gets back to a broader kind of overlap of, you know, if you look at the Venn diagram between illegal and unethical, it's kind of how much is there overlap between there. Honest services has been an attempt by a lot of people to kind of shove unethical into the illegal space. And the courts kind of said, well, it's not, you can't do that. It can't just be a free roving ethics law. It has to actually tie back to specific elements, specific offenses that are known in advance. And I think that's going to be a tension that's going to continue into the future, and we'll see how that develops. Because whenever somebody does something that people kind of look at and are like, that's horrible, how could they do that? That seems wrong. You get this impulse to try to reach for a criminal law, and this seems to be one of the more common ones it's reached for. So it'll be interesting to see kind of what the next area that develops. That, like I said, this seems to come up to the court at least every 3 or 4 years. I suspect that will remain true, although maybe that's just a pessimistic thought.
All right. So I think that brings us to the end of our episode. So Gary Lukowski, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.